You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I am your host, Courtney Coulson. This is Minute 15. This minute opens with Holloway having just woken up for cryo, and ends with Fifield saying, "I ain't here to be your friend." Ellie looks around the mess hall while Holloway pours something into a glass. We don't see what, exactly. Shaw is apparently supposed to have a British accent. I didn't notice until I researched this movie for this podcast. I don't even know why it would matter if she had a Swedish accent or not. It's sort of like how Doctor Strange doesn't really need to have an American accent. You can just have Benedict have his British accent. No one's that fussed. Ridley found Noomi when watching Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. He seems to, yeah, have a real eye for actors. He's always looking for people, and I think Noomi was a great choice. But other actresses considered for the role were Anne Hathaway, Gemma Arterton, whom I am in love with, Natalie Portman, Carey Mulligan, and Abby Cornish. I love Noomi, but those are all fine actresses too. I could totally imagine any of them in this role. Carey Mulligan would be especially interesting because she's this very pixie-like. She's very small and delicate, so to see her as the lead in an alien film would certainly be a surprise. The makeup and styling for Elizabeth is very soft and feminine. She is very doll-like, but she's also, you know, very chiseled. You know, her bone structure is quite sharp, and then she's friggin' jacked, so... Yeah, she looks like an action hero, whereas putting Carey Mulligan in that scenario would certainly be a surprise. You'd look at her and go, yeah, she's dead. She is not going to make it out of the first act alive. Milburn is right behind Holloway and Shaw at the serving counter, and yet in the next shot, Chance and Ravel are in front of him. Did they cut in line? It's not a well-edited moment either way. It is so obvious when you're actually looking out for it. But that's not an uncommon cheat that I notice in a lot of movies. So if they do need to make a rough cut, they sort of fool your eye a bit. So they make sure the character that your eye is drawn to is still the character in the same spot, roughly. Next, we see Ford getting some kind of purple drink. I like Ford. She doesn't get to do much, but she has a good presence. I think they really cast a fine crew. Everyone is memorable, even in the smallest roles. Vickers stalks out into the mess hall, attracting the gaze of Chance and Ravel. She looks perfect, inhumanly so. She commands more authority than anyone else on the ship, with slick, tied back hair in this kind of chignon and that incredible suit. Here's an excerpt from the Close on Film interview with Janti Yates. Janti says, "The Nehru-style suits worn by David, Meredith Vickers, and Peter Weyland were intended as a Weyland Industries design, like a uniform. Pierce's suit was made by Timothy Everest, tailors in London. Close on Film. Charlize Theron looked stunning in that sculpted suit. Janti, her suit is just the best thing. My cutter, Dominic Young, is amazing. He works with Sandy Powell, Colleen Atwood, they're quite famous costume designers also. I was very lucky to have him. I was really blown away every time I saw Charlize. It just really worked. It's made from one of the most expensive suiting fabrics I've ever used. It's silk and vicuna. It has a slight sheen to it." Close on Film. "What was your overall costume budget for this film?" Janti. "Honestly, I don't know. We did do a budget and we were hammered down. We didn't have any way to chisel, though. If the spacesuits weren't charged up and maintained, the film wouldn't get finished. Really, the first week of shooting was very difficult until we had the overnight crew who came in to maintain all this stuff. Really, I don't have the physical time to go poring over things. It costs what it costs, and I go away and do it. Nobody queues up at the box office because you come in under budget." That must be nice. Every once in a while, I do get a costume commission where the customer says, "I want this to be as accurate and detailed and elaborate as possible. Whatever it costs, just make it happen." And I'm just like, bless you. Yes, I can make it perfect. There can be some fun working in a very tight budget as well. You know, I'll always have a fondness for the old Doctor Who episodes where they've had like $50 to work with, and so you got cardboard and aluminium and dishwashing gloves, just whatever they could find, and they just paint it silver and there you go, you've got a Cyberman. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I enjoy costumes no matter what. Now, Vicar's suit is incredible, but it always bugged me that there's something weird going on with the breast pockets in this scene. They're a bit puffy, and the one on our right has a bit of a wrinkle in it. It should be super crisp, and they do correct it in later scenes, but I don't know how they let that happen. Thanks to Yannick hanging up the Christmas tree, this does count as a Christmas movie. You're welcome. Idris is often wasted in these big genre films. He doesn't even seem to enjoy them. They are just the most direct path to success these days. He's clearly a leading man, but he's a bit role here. Though his character does get a decent arc. Don't get me started on Star Trek Beyond. He was wasted in that part. He could have been great. I mean, a Star Trek villain. Ah. I would love to see him star in something with Charlize again. They have good chemistry. I mean, I feel like she has good chemistry with just about anyone. Yannick is smoking on the ship. Is that advisable? He's very casual. He's not intimidated by Meredith at all. This interaction suggests to me that they're already acquainted with each other. Perhaps she hired him personally. She doesn't seem to mind that he isn't subordinate to her. She's probably not used to dealing with many people talking back to her. She might even find this attractive. We'll see that in later minutes. As they're talking, there's a man in the lower left of the frame who seems to be fiddling with a phone. It's holoprojecting some green image. I just thought that was fun. Even in 2093, people gotta check their Instagram or whatever. Actually, there wouldn't be any Wi-Fi, so I guess he's looking at whatever he saved on his phone, or maybe the ship has an extensive database he can access from his phone. Milburn is a sweet boy. He sits down at Fifield's table and introduces himself. Of course, Fifield is a big meanie. Side note, Milburn's glasses are apparently vintage, so they would be mega vintage by 2093. What a hipster. We get everything we need to know about these two in this moment. Milburn is open and friendly. Fifield is clearly in a bad mood, but Milburn chose to approach him anyway. That same lack of restraint will, of course, be his undoing in the end. Milburn is apparently oblivious to danger. Fifield looks like Cryo was harder on him than anyone else. His voice is hoarse and he's hunched over like he's got the worst hangover imaginable. I actually don't know what a hangover feels like, so I can't actually imagine, but I will say that for the benefit of you, the listener. There's another guy sitting next to Fifield with a free seat in front of him, so there's every possibility Milburn could have chosen that guy to talk to instead. Fifield has a more distinctive look, however. Perhaps he was simply drawn to the more colourful-looking guy. Friend of the show Steph says that Fifield's design made her think he was going to be Russian. I can't unsee this. It makes sense, though I can't say why. Fifield is basically that guy on every reality show ever who says he's not there to make friends, he's there to win slash make money. And that always works out well for them, doesn't it? We now return to our semi-regular segment, Reading the Script. Hypersleep compartment. All the freezers are open and empty, save two. Holloway lies in one. In the next, Watts. Three men in blue coveralls crouch beside Watts's freezer, staring inside. They are Downs, 30, a lean, fidgety crewman. Not sure who that would have been. Stillwell, 40, a sturdy fellow with the geniality of a Labrador. That's definitely Milburn. And Kamarov, 26, whose dark, brooding air belongs to a man twice his age, so that would be Fifield, I suppose. Downs, look at that. Kamarov opens the lid of Watts's freezer, leans over her. Watts stirs in her sleep. A drowsy angel. The script is unrelenting, believe me. Kamarov. She wakes up slow. Watts wakes to find three men looming over her. Disoriented, she pulls away, tangles her hands in her IV lines. Holloway, off-screen. Get out of there. Holloway's voice cracks like a whip. The crewmen jump back. Holloway sits up in the next freezer over. He yanks the IV lines out of his arms and legs, climbs out of the freezer. Stillwell, just looking. Holloway, give us a moment, will you? The crewmen file out. Stillwell, sheepishly. Downs and Kamarov, surly. Holloway goes to Watts, gently removes the IV lines from her ankles while she plucks the ones from her arms. Watts, I'm out of sorts, sorry. Holloway, never worry. He helps her up. Interior, mess room. Holloway and Watts sit at a table, both a bit hungover. They wear civilian clothes. Warmly dressed, they still look cold. They nurse mugs of coffee and nibble packaged snack bars. Watts hunches over, shivering. My head's buzzing. Holloway, you just slept 2.5 years. It'll pass. Watts, like you've done this before. Holloway, I've read all about it. Two ship's officers enter the room wearing blue coveralls with rank insignia. Glass, 45, a stocky man with thick black hair, and Brick, 50, a bold man with a bristling mustache. They look at Watts and Holloway with little pleasure. Brick, sleep okay? Watts, yes, thanks. Glass, Captain will see you now. Interior, Magellan, Captain's war room. Captain Yannick, 45, sits at his desk with his bristling beard, seems to be quite the fashion on this ship, and powerful build, he has a swashbuckling look, like the captain of a whaling ship. Holloway and Watts sit on a steel bench in front of him. He sits scanning his orders. A plastic packet with Wayland Industries logos, cracked open. Watermarked papers inside. Yannick. Zeta 2 Reticuli was surveyed already, 100 years ago. Watts. By an unmanned probe, very crude. Yannick. No Earth-like planets. Watts. No. Yannick. So, what are you looking for? Holloway. Proof of the engineer's existence. Watts. Confirmation of Professor Holloway's theories would change everything. There'd be science before Holloway and after. Yannick rubs his face warily with his hands. Your ticket. I'll put the ship where you want. Run your scans. Holloway. Captain, your crew's been up for a week. We could have used the time. Why did you wait to wake us? Yannick. Better for discipline. Men ship out as prospectors for one reason, the percentage. Find a gold mine or a habitable planet and you're set for life. But this contract says no percentage. No bounty. Just triple pay. The men ain't happy. Holloway. You unhappy too? Yannick. I'm always unhappy. He stands, presses his palms against a wall panel. A safe opens. He pulls out a massive pistol in a gun belt, tosses the orders in the safe, lays the gun atop them, and locks it up. Scientist cabin. Holloway and Watts take possession of their cabin, a simple but spacious room with twin beds and a window to the stars. They drop duffel bags on the bed. Holloway surveys the arrangement, frowns. He releases the magnets that lock the bed down. Slide the beds together. Interior, scientist workroom, day. Holloway and Watts set up their workspace. A central display table and huge display surfaces on the walls. Fascinating documents slide under their fingertips. An engineer alphabet, ancient art, climate and genetic data. David appears in the doorway. Watts. David, I wondered when we'd see you. David. I trust your database is in order. I set it up myself. Watts. All's well, I think. David turns to go, hesitates in the doorway. I should tell you, the time you spent sleeping, I spent studying your research. Holloway and Watts look at the android, his words sinking in. Watts. You studied our work for 2.5 years. David. It's quite a data set. Holloway. So you've seen everything? Well, what did you think? David glances over the documents displayed around the room. Your hypothesis is bold, the audacity of it. Your climate data is undeniable. The Holocene epoch was engineered. Dr. Watts, your genetic studies are equally conclusive. Pulses of cultural change are harder to prove, but even there, your case is strong. I believe in your engineers. All right, that about covers it. This is Coulson, signing off. You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.